after I interviewed him for Meet the Press, I'm really concerned about what Trump, the president-elect, is going to do with immigration and its impact on the recovery. We got more undocumented people in L.A. than any other city in the country. I think it's 10% of the population. They are the prime targets standing in Home Depot parking lots. Not the worst of the worst, but the people that are engaged in the rebuilding of Los Angeles are the ones being targeted by the ICE raids right now. We've seen people run and die getting hit by cars on freeways by these operations. You know what they're doing? They're trying to find work rebuilding homes in Altadena and the Palisades. That's who the Trump administration is targeting, as Gavin Newsom points out.
We just have 20 seconds. People losing their homes, their property, they already had their houses burned down.
Well, and here's the thing. 40% of the homes and the lots that are selling now are going to corporate investors, not locals. LA is the most unaffordable city in the country and the most unaffordable state in the union. This book will show you the fissures that lie beneath our society that are exposed when a firestorm like this happens.
Jacob Soboroff, senior political national reporter for MS Now, new book, Firestorm, The Great Los Angeles Fires and America's New Age of Disaster. On Monday, we'll speak with filmmaker Andy Timiner about her film, All the Walls Came Down, about losing her home. We'll also speak with the main protagonist, the community activist in Altadena, Heavenly Hughes. That does it for our show. The film has been shortlisted for an Oscar. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland will evict homeless shelter residents.
The City Council of Longview, Washington picks a new mayor.
And, in international news, the U.S. stops two oil tankers linked to Venezuela.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 7th, 2026. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson says the City of Portland plans to evict 80 to 90 residents from its 10 alternative safe rest villages sometime next month. Mayor Wilson told the Oregonian, quote, "The City of Portland cannot indefinitely utilize emergency units with individuals unwilling to engage with those who are here to help them. Any resident who is considered unwilling to engage and has been at the shelter for 120 days or more will be asked to leave," end quote. Wilson went on to say, quote, "Exiting due to stay limits only occurs after many months, or in some cases years, of persistent attempts to connect and collaborate with no level of engagement." In September, Portland introduced requirements that those moving into the safe rest villages adhere to a 120-day stay limit and engage with local services. City officials believe the new requirements would incentivize people to use this system and then move into permanent housing. Molly Hogan, executive director of Welcome Home Coalition, based in Portland, believes removing vulnerable people may be counterproductive. Hogan says, quote, "Removing people from shelter does not end homelessness. It punishes individuals for being poor." What's mind-boggling about this new policy from the mayor, who ran on ending unsheltered homelessness, is that it will put nearly 100 people back out on the literal street, end quote. Since the advent of the safe rest villages throughout the city, local residents have complained that the upmarket area is now experiencing an uptick in antisocial behaviors, including satellite camping, drug use, and drug sales. Wilson said some exemptions will apply to current residents, including those a shelter manager chooses to waive or for people experiencing severe mental health and acuity challenges.
Multnomah County District Attorney Nathan Vasquez said he'll pursue drug charges against people who don't meaningfully engage with the county's deflection program. Vasquez said, quote, "From now on, they'll have 90 days to show that they've actually taken some meaningful steps towards getting into treatment, making some steps to change their life," end quote. When the Oregon legislature recriminated simple drug possession, Multnomah County launched a deflection program back in September of 2024. The rollback of Measure 110 gave Oregon counties the choice of providing deflection as an alternative to arrests and prosecution of possession of drugs, but gave few specifics on how those respective programs should be run. The flexibility or lack of guidance gave Oregon's three Portland metro counties the green light to come up with their own models. Each county adopted wildly different plans with significantly different expectations of people who chose deflection. Vasquez argued that Multnomah County's deflection programs lack any real accountability. That's why, he says, as of January 5th, he'll pursue prosecution of anyone who fails to meaningfully engage with deflection. In the first 3 months of deflection in 2025, there were five people who chose treatment instead of arrests. Just one of those five went into a withdrawal management program. Multnomah County's deflection program cost roughly $8 million in its first year. That equates to 520 people that local law enforcement referred to that deflection, or fewer than two per day. Just over 100 people completed deflection, which means they followed through on a referral.
The City Council of Longview, Washington, will select a new mayor tomorrow. The city operates under what's referred to as a weak mayor form of government. The City Council votes on local policies and ordinances, while the new city manager carries out those priorities while overseeing city departments and budgets. In November, local voters elected three new city councilors, Chris Bryant, Mike Claxton, and Wayne Nichols. The full seven-member council selects a mayor from their peers once every 2 years. Current mayor Spencer Boudreau will step down from his role as mayor and city councilor following his election loss this past fall. Longview's new council will weigh several financial projects in 2026, according to city manager Jennifer Wills. Councilors will consider a new potential tax increase for a new fire station, bolster local economic development in the manufacturing community, and have to balance a $4 million budget deficit in the 2027-2028 biennium. Bryant, Claxton, and Nichols will begin their four-year terms in 2026. The three new councilors were sworn in on December 11th to begin the council's transition period.
Portland City Council came back into session this morning. Their first and ultimately only order of business today was electing a new council president and vice president. The meeting went for hours, starting at 9:30 and lasting until 4:30. For five rounds of voting, the votes were tied 6-6 between current elect president Elena Pirtle Gurney and Councilor Samir Canal. It wasn't clear before the meeting if Pirtle Gurney would face a challenger. Last year, there were nine rounds of voting deadlocked until Pirtle Gurney was elected, after one of the progressive city councilors, Mitch Green, flipped the vote. Now progressive councilors say they're owed one, throwing their support behind Samir Canal. No president was selected. Council reconvenes tomorrow. High utility bills can bring stress for families and business owners, especially in the winter. But experts say from making sure all the air gaps in your home are filled to turning down the thermostat, there are a number of low-cost or free things Oregonians can do to lower their heating bills this season and beyond. Isabel Charlet has more.
In the face of rising utility rates this winter, experts say there are many cheap or low-cost strategies Oregonians can use around their homes to save on their energy bills. Jamie Seymour is with the Energy Trust of Oregon, a nonprofit that helps people and businesses save energy and money. She says heating is most often a household's largest energy expense, especially during winter, but it's also likely their biggest opportunity to save. For starters, she recommends paying careful attention to any place where warm air can escape.
All those little small gaps and cracks around the house, whether that is around your windows, your pipes, your exhaust fans, all of those in a typical home can add up to about the same loss of energy and comfort as leaving a window open year-round.
Seymour says it is best to focus on sealing up gaps before adding insulation in order to get the most benefits from it. Research shows nearly one in three Americans struggled to pay utility bills last year. Seymour adds one of the easiest ways to save money is keep your thermostat a little lower. She recommends keeping it around 66 degrees while at home and lowering it by a few degrees at night or when no one is home. She also encourages people to change their air filters every 3 months or more during heavy use seasons to keep heating and cooling systems efficient.
If you check it and your air filter is dirty, change it. Because a dirty air filter is really going to make your system work a lot harder. And that's a big waste on energy.
If people are struggling to pay utility bills, they should check with their utility provider, which may have programs to help, especially during the winter, adds Seymour. She says Energy Trust of Oregon offers cash incentives that lower the cost of energy-saving tools like insulation, windows, and heat pumps, with higher incentives for low- to moderate-income households. For Oregon News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
5 years after the January 6th riot, watchdogs warned that disputes over voter data and mail-in ballot rules could hamper smooth and fair midterms. They say misinformation is still undermining confidence in American elections. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're very proud to fight back and stand up for Maine voters, the right to their own privacy, and to push back against a pretty unlawful demand.
Jen Lancaster with the League of Women Voters of Maine says they're watching lawsuits that question state election policies ahead of the midterms. The Trump administration is suing 18 mostly blue states, seeking voter registration data. Lancaster warns the driver's license and partial social security numbers could be used to improperly remove eligible voters. The White House says the lawsuits are meant to ensure compliance with federal election laws. It wants to expand an online citizenship confirmation system, which watchdogs warn has previously stopped legitimate votes. Others say a new postal rule could mean mail-in ballots are rejected for arriving late. Michael Shumidas with the Rural Democracy Initiative says the USPS won't postmark mail as quickly, a big issue for people in 70% of zip codes.
The people in rural communities are going to be hit twice. Our mail is going to take longer to get there, and the documents that need a postmark are going to show the wrong date. And this is going to lead to a whole lot of people having their votes discounted because of this policy choice.
The Postal Service says the efficiency measure will save money. They advise mailing ballots earlier, getting a manual postmark. On the fifth anniversary of January 6th, the White House unveiled a new webpage praising President Donald Trump's actions that day. It blames Democrats for what it calls the real insurrection, defends the president's pardons for the rioters, and accuses the Capitol Police of escalating the conflict. Former members of the House Committee on the Riot say the website and ongoing attacks on them are an effort to rewrite history and support the big lie that the election was stolen. Speaking to congressional Republicans, Trump again warned of drastic consequences if the party loses this fall.
Because if we don't win the midterms, it's just going to be, they'll find a reason to impeach me. I'll get impeached.
Administration officials are openly discussing invading Greenland. Missouri Republican Senator Eric Schmidt says it's a national security priority.
When you look at a map sort of from the top of the globe, you realize the significance that Greenland has in the Western Hemisphere for our own defense here in the United States.
European allies support Denmark's control of Greenland and warn a use of force could threaten NATO. The people living on the island strongly oppose American intervention and say their future can't be imposed by Washington. Hilton says it's removing a Minnesota hotel from its booking system after reports it denied rooms to immigration agents. Conservative journalist Nick Sorter posted a secret video showing he was refused a room while posing as a federal official Monday. He says that was after Hilton apologized.
They lied. Hilton and the Hampton Inn out here and Everpeak Hospitality lied.
The company says the booking decisions were made by one independent franchise. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you?
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Oregon Arts Watch Executive Director Laura Grimes on the end of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. At 6, it's Flashpoints. Then at 7, listen in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, you can expect scattered showers with an overnight low of 30 degrees. Tomorrow, look for clouds with a chance of a thunderstorm and a possibility of hail. Expect a high temperature of 45. On January 7, 1955, American contralto Marian Anderson becomes the first African-American to sing at the Metropolitan Opera House. The quote of the day is from Italian poet and writer Dante Alighieri, who said, quote, "The darkest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis."
Last November, a young humpbacked whale stranded on the shore near the coastal community of Yahats had to be euthanized. Rescue efforts to put the 10-ton, 28-foot-long marine mammal back into the ocean failed. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last November, a stranded humpback whale near Yahats had to be euthanized after rescue efforts to put the 10-ton, 28-foot-long mammal back into the ocean failed. As Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports, what followed became a meaningful collaboration between the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians and a team from Oregon State University.
In mid-November, volunteers worked around the clock to keep the whale doused in seawater and to try pulling it back into the sea. Video from the Oregonian captured some of those harried efforts. Finally, on-site stranding experts and veterinarians agreed to put the whale down. A necropsy team from OSU prepared to remove samples to determine how the whale lived before getting tangled in crab pot line. Kurt Williams is the director of the Oregon Veterinary Diagnostic Lab.
I've never done a necropsy exam on a whale before. I don't think I'll have another opportunity. I hope I don't have another opportunity because I don't want this to happen to these animals.
Another group of roughly 20 Siletz tribal members also came. Among them was Lisa Norton, chief administrative officer for the tribe. She said they began by laying down tobacco and praying with Williams' team.
We offer up prayers for the animal and the bounty it's going to give us. People kind of did their own thing. They prayed in whatever way was comfortable for them, but we just spent some time taking in the enormity of the task.
There's been a historic tension between tribes and scholars, often due to academic institutions pillaging remains and artifacts from native burial mounds and village sites. But these two groups, standing side by side with the whale, worked in tandem, conferring with each other as they worked against the incoming tide and pending sunset. Again, Lisa Norton and Kurt Williams.
We were able to get them to get more specimens than they would have otherwise. That resulted in them finishing quicker and getting more samples had they just done it on their own, but also allowed us to preserve more parts of the whale for future use.
Being able to work alongside the members of the Siletz tribe was amazing.
The Siletz have stored 1,500 pounds of blubber for possible soap or oil, while the whale's skeleton has been buried for possible use later as a museum piece. While the whale's death was a sad event for many, the collaboration between the tribe and university gave a primer for how to handle similar incidents in the future. Angela Sandana is the Natural Resources Director for the Siletz.
We would anticipate that if something similar happened, that we would revive those relationships and collaborations that we've built from this experience.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Indian Health Service, or IHS, recently announced 7 projects to build or renovate healthcare facilities, often in rural areas throughout Indian country. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, one of those beneficiaries will be Arizona's Akchin Indian community.
The tribe's chairman, Gabriel Lopez, is grateful.
Currently, we have a satellite facility, which is 2,000 square feet. It's a triple white trailer with minimal services.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. met with the Akchin Indian community in November. After that visit, he made a social media post with Lopez.
The elders in the community have to drive 60 to 80 miles to get decent care, and they have to go through Maricopa County with all the traffic. So it's an inconvenience, and it can be a lethal inconvenience.
Akchin will construct a 60,000-square-foot facility and lease it at no cost to IHS for two decades. In exchange, the agency will lobby Congress on behalf of the tribe for federal funding to staff and maintain the building.
In a roundabout way, we're looking at maybe about 2 years to be up and running.
I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The new U.S. Postal Service postmark rules could delay mail-in ballots for U.S. residents by dating them days after submission, a change that advocates warn will disproportionately impact rural voters and lead to more ballots being rejected. Critics argue the policy could further disenfranchise voters. Judith Ruiz Branch reports from Illinois.
New rules from the U.S. Postal Service on postmarks could have significant impact on rural voters and mail-in ballot processing in Illinois and across the country. Under the new system, mail will not receive a postmark on the day it is submitted to the local post office. Instead, the postmark will be applied only after the mail is transported to a separate regional processing facility, potentially resulting in postmarks dated one or more days after the actual submission date. Michael Shemitis with the nonprofit Rural Democracy Initiative says the changes will impact about 70% of zip codes nationwide.
People in rural communities are going to be hit twice. Our mail is going to take longer to get there, and then the documents that need a postmark are going to show the wrong date, and this is going to lead to a whole lot of people having their votes discounted because of this policy choice.
More than a million Illinois residents voted by mail in the 2024 presidential election. Shemitis says people mailing time-sensitive documents should allow for extra delivery time or ask for a manual postmark or a certificate of mailing at the local post office. In 2024, more than 100,000 mail-in ballots nationwide were rejected for missing the deadline. Shemita says that number will soar under the new policy and disenfranchise voters. He argues additional planned post office service cuts and closures in rural communities only further compounds matters.
They're really reducing the footprint of the Postal Service for communities that are farther away from urban centers. And really for everyone in the country, but particularly for rural people, the Postal Service is a really important function. It delivers everything from prescription drugs to mail-in ballots. And these are services that really should be bolstering in really the opposite direction.
Shemita says the change is part of a larger agenda of the Trump administration to create voting barriers and reduce services for rural communities. The USPS cites saving money and improving efficiency as reasons for the policy change. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Most banks, financial firms, and insurance companies publicly support mitigating climate change. However, new reporting from the Pulitzer Center for Investigative Reporting shows they're helping oil and gas companies build new infrastructure and tap new oil reserves that leading global scientists warn if burned would produce catastrophic outcomes. Eric Galatis has more.
Many banks, financial firms, and insurance companies have made bold public commitments to do their part to rein in climate change. But the Pulitzer Center for Investigative Reporting has revealed that those same companies are financing the search for new sources of fossil fuels and new infrastructure to burn them. According to Global Scientific Consensus, tapping any new oil and gas reserves will likely produce catastrophic outcomes. Josephine Molds, a reporter with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, says there's enough oil and gas already in the pipeline to fuel a clean energy transition.
We've got enough in terms of the projects that we've already got running. We've got enough to keep us going as long as we shift over to solar and wind and all of the other renewables.
Companies continue to promote their climate commitments and argue that if they didn't do business with corporations searching for new places to drill, they wouldn't be able to work with any existing oil and gas company. President Donald Trump has called climate change a hoax and has put the brakes on U.S. efforts to transition to clean energy. The administration has also making good on campaign promises to ramp up oil and gas production and has laid claim to the world's largest oil reserves in Venezuela. According to a 2024 Joint Senate Committee report, the oil and gas industry has known about the impacts of burning fossil fuels on climate since at least 1959 and has engaged in PR campaigns of denial, disinformation, and doublespeak for the past six decades. Moltz notes the impacts of a warming planet are already being felt.
People living near coal-fired power plants or where fracking has happened, or even the people affected by wildfires. These are huge impacts on our daily lives.
After Moltz's reporting exposed backroom dealing and preferential treatment on plans to extract oil and gas from the world's last rainforest that stores more carbon than it emits, the Democratic Republic of Congo scrapped a major leasing auction. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
The U.S. military seized two Shadow Fleet oil tankers linked to Venezuelan oil earlier today. One of them, a Russian-flagged vessel they've been chasing for weeks, was seized in the North Atlantic between Iceland and Scotland. That ship, the Marinera, was carrying no oil, but had tried weeks ago to get into Venezuela to load up. The British Navy gave logistical support by air and sea. The seized tanker was reportedly escorted by a Russian submarine. However, U.S. forces were able to board the tanker without facing any resistance. The ship's registry was changed to Russian soon after being stopped December 21st by the U.S. Coast Guard in the Caribbean. Moscow denounced the seizure of the tanker sailing under its flag and demanded the U.S. treat Russians on board properly and permit them to return to Russia quickly. The Russian Transport Ministry said it gave the vessel temporary permission to use the Russian flag, adding that no state had the right to use force against vessels properly registered in other states' jurisdictions. The military said the other ship, the MT Sophia, a stateless sanctioned dark fleet motor tanker, was seized in international waters in the Caribbean. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said, quote, "Venezuela's leadership is cooperating with the U.S. on the second tanker. They understand that the only way they can move oil and generate revenue and not have economic collapse is if they cooperate and work with the United States," end quote.
In other oil news, the Center for Biological Diversity just released an analysis of the Trump administration's five-year plan for offshore drilling. Their report found that the increase in drilling could lead to an additional 4,232 oil spills and dump an extra 12.1 million gallons of oil into ocean and Gulf waters. The administration's new plan includes as many as 34 potential offshore lease sales across American coasts, covering approximately 1.27 billion acres along the Alaska and Pacific coasts in the Gulf of Mexico. This is in addition to the 35 new oil leases that were in last year's Republican budget reconciliation package. Brittany Hardy, senior attorney with Earth Justice, said, quote, "The Trump administration is threatening to impose offshore drilling on states, cities, and communities that have fought against it for decades." Hardy went on to say, quote, "Trump's plan would risk the health and well-being of millions of people who live along our coasts. It would also devastate ocean ecosystems that both humans and animals rely on. This administration continues to put the oil industry above people, our shared environment, and the law," end quote. Kristen Munsell, the center's oceans legal director, said, quote, "Trump's ridiculously reckless drilling plan could cause thousands of new oil spills threatening almost every U.S. coast. Nobody wants beaches and marine life coated in crude, but that'll be our future if Trump's scheme goes forward," end quote.
On January 3rd, KBOO's poet Dan Raphael stopped saying Happy New Year.
Vietnam, Venezuela, who's next? Vienna, Venice, California? It's crucial for all to love America, no matter where you fall on the political or any other spectrum, to confront our nation's greatest threat, President Trump. It's all about the oil, which kills more people than heroin, fentanyl, etc. It's all about the money paying Trump to increase their already burgeoning profits. What can we do? Protest? Donate? Talk about it? Be positive? Be generous, especially on the local and one-to-one levels? Be a true patriot, responsible and compassionate? It's important for the Democrats to get back control of the House and or Senate, but elections are 10 months away, assuming they're allowed to happen. We can't wait that long. If the U.S. can seize Venezuela without consequences, what'll stop China from taking Taiwan, Russia from taking all of the Ukraine? I was telling folks I was optimistic about 2026 while realizing we might not have hit bottom yet, just didn't think we'd be plummeting that way this fast this soon. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, January 7th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Dave Johnson, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Eric Alatas, Judith Ruiz Branch, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KABU programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text to KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about some of the latest arts news in our region. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. You've brought two stories forward for us today, both of them about the closing of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB. The first one is from Jim Redden. It's called Corporation for Public Broadcasting Dissolved as Trump's Arts